Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructed Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I'm joined by my co-hosts. Two guys going to Hawaii for the Pro Tour. Casey Bloodworth.
Hey, what's up?
And Michael Hinderocker.
Hey, what's also up?
Probably the same thing.
Yeah, sometimes times change, people change.
Real quick.
It wasn't a lot of time for change, but not none.
You know, I don't know why I didn't expect Casey to say, hey, what's up, but I was caught off guard.
I feel like I say it literally every week.
Yeah, there's a thing that we have going where we say things.
It's true. It's called a podcast.
Yeah. I am, like, unreal tired. My wife says I say that every day. I probably say it a lot, but I am so tired today. I had to go to church for a baby blessing for my nephew, and that was exhausting. So I'm just out of it today, so hopefully these guys can carry the show this week. No jokes about how you carry it every week, Casey?
I was going to, until you interrupted me.
All right. Well, don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by Patreon.com. You can go to Patreon.com/CCMTG to become a patron of the show. It starts at $1. You can donate any amount you see fit per month. And we appreciate that everything that anyone has the opportunity to donate. It really does mean the world to us. Thank you so much to everybody who can. And if you can't, don't forget that the podcast will always be free. Hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is kind of the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you are getting worse. And you should always be striving for greatness and doing the things that you need to do to put yourself in the best position to improve, get better, and win. And so, Casey, this week, how did you get better at magic?
Well, I've been feeling very, very antsy in anticipation of the Pro Tour. Haven't really, like, had magic tournaments to plan for the most part other than the one at Comic-Con. And haven't really known what to do with myself as far as magic. So I really dedicated myself a lot to trying to watch a lot of videos, watch a lot of coverage, watch a lot of streams, just kind of get into people's headspace, understand why people make plays the way they do, why people played certain decks they do, so that I just try to understand magic players from other people's, or magic from other people's perspectives more.
Cool. Michael, what about you? How did you get better at magic this week?
Well, I saw some spoilers that looked like things I couldn't really comprehend as far as vehicles go, so then I gave up on looking at new cards and instead built sealed pools for the current format since going to GP Louisville at the end of the week. So trying to get better
excited?
At that. I am. Yeah.
You're going to get qualified for the following Pro Tour on that one?
I'm going to get carried by two much better players than myself.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. And also, two great players in Matt Clayton and Alex Sittern. So it'll be a really fun weekend for you, I think.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So just trying to prepare enough to not get in the way of their greatness.
You're so humble. Every week.
I mean, it's pretty hard to get in the way of Matt Clayton's greatness. Right?
I mean, he's good for nothing.
Right. You have to work pretty hard just to find it, much less get in the way of it.
That could have gone either way. Like you could have, they could have been like, he's so good you can't get in the way. Like you can try to get in the way and it's just not going to happen. And you had to go with that route.
I mean, we're not going to say something nice about Matt Kling.
Right. What if he listens?
Yeah. What if he hears it? It'll go right to his head. Right to it. This week, I got a play in the Comic-Con Magic tournament here in Salt Lake. It was a qualifier for the Game Grid Invitational. So it was the Game Grid Open, they called it. And yeah, it was really fun. I got to play our new and improved ramp list that Austin and myself did fairly well with at the tournament. And yeah, I took the whole thing down, even though I'm pretty sure Michael let me win.
No, I really didn't.
Did you think about it?
Did I think about letting you win?
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd actually been going to win, I may have let you win, but I didn't let you win.
Fair enough. I had a lot of fun this weekend. I continued my goal of being better at mulliganing. It's been going really well for me lately. And also, you know, tried new different sideboard technology, different ways to sideboard. Just trying to continue to improve at Magic without playing in PPTQs, because I can't go to Aether Revolt. So, you know, having an event to play in was a pretty big deal for me, and I had a lot of fun, and hopefully the boxes that we won sell for a nice chunk of change, and I can buy my wife something beautiful. You know about that?
Lottery tickets?
Yeah, we live in Utah. I don't know that that's happening.
It sounds like Dev must be listening to this podcast as well. It's only a 2-hour drive.
So
along with Matt Kling, Dev is also a listener, is what I'm taking away from that statement.
She used to listen to the podcast. When we were dating and she lived in Cedar City, she would listen to the podcast to hear my voice.
Nice.
I wish that the listeners could have heard the crickets that I heard after you said that.
The literal crickets?
Yeah, the actual crickets. I feel like that would have been a really nice touch.
You as a listener can actually... you can't hear the crickets that are outside my house, but you can join in every week by going to patreon.com/ccmtg. If you post something for us to talk about the show, we'll talk about it during the hashtag always improving segment. This week, the Patreon listeners actually got to pick the subject of the show. So thank you to you guys. And we'll get to that when we get to the training grounds. Let's talk about card of the week, though, that is brought to you by Patreon. If you... What?
No, nothing. No, I forgot that I wrote that.
Oh, thank you. Anyway, also shout out to Casey for writing the show this week. I was laying on the couch and I was like, I don't want to do this. Will you do it? And he did it, and he's great. So thank you, Casey.
No problem.
The card of the week this week is Collective Brutality. Casey, what is Collective Brutality, and why did you make it card of the week?
So it is one in a black for a sorcery that has... It's a little spell, has three modes you can choose from, and it has Escalate, letting you discard a card to choose an additional mode. The three modes are target an opponent reveals their hand, you get to choose an instant or sorcery from it and remove it from their hand, and target creature gets -2/-2, and target opponent loses 2 life and you gain 2 life.
I played against this card this week.
Yeah, it's popping up kind of all over Standard and Modern. Standard really only as like a Delirium enabler, but Modern both as a Delirium enabler and a way to filter out cards that aren't good for the matchup, let you kind of play a wider net of cards in your deck because they don't all need to be all-stars, because you can cash one of them in basically to get an extra card of equity, either by killing a creature and taking a spell, or just gaining a little bit of life against the deck where that's relevant. So it's really kind of been one of the keys to the Abzan and Jund Flare decks in Modern, as well as kind of has been around in some of the, quote, Soul Tie Emerge and other black control strategies in Standard.
Yeah, I think this card is, like, sort of subtly powerful. It definitely, when you think of, you know, charms or styles of cards like that, you're always paying a little bit more for the effect. Here, you're paying quite a bit more for each effect, but the ability to get both of them at the same time without spending any additional mana, like, you know, 2-mana removal spell or whatever, 2-mana very conditional removal spell isn't great, but this card is a lot about flexibility, and then the ability to, like, I don't know, I'm imagining getting to, like, kill a Goblin Guide and take a Boros Charm or something, and that's pretty insane.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I've seen, where, like, you get to ditch some cards that just, like, aren't good. Like in the example against Burn, say I'm ditching like Liliana of the Veils, which are like just don't really are kind of low impact cards, and I get to...
Interesting.
You think that card's good against Burn?
It's okay. It's not your worst card against them.
I just think it's a card that you're usually playing four of that oftentimes you board out.
Sure.
I feel like though too, in a lot of these matchups where you're playing against the faster decks, if you're dying with Abzan or Jund or whatever, you're probably dying with cards still in your hand.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Like Collective Brutality, even though you're not getting a great rate, it like sort of allows you to cast multiple spells for the same amount of mana.
Yeah, that's my opinion of it too, is like if like Liliana might actually be a good example where like I don't know that I'm gonna get to cast this card in this game, so I'm gonna ditch it kind of what Casey said, for, you know, to remove a spell from their hand, you know, which will do the equivalent of what Liliana would have done, but I had got to spend no mana on it.
Yeah, if you spend 2 mana and then discard a Liliana and a land, let's say, and you get to duress them, kill a creature, and gain 2 life.
Yeah.
And that, potentially, that's a powerful effect in that matchup.
And potentially, like, turn on your Tarmogoyf, or turn on your Grimflayer, rather, or speed up your Tarmogoyf clock.
Yeah, exactly. Speed up your clock, slow down theirs. Like, this card does not look powerful on the surface, but in play, I've been very, very impressed with the card.
Yeah, sometimes even doing something like discarding a Lingering Souls will allow you to, like, cast the backside of it. Something like that. I mean, it has a lot of play to it.
Yep. So we're going to give out a Collective Brutality to Adam W., one of our patrons. If you want to be eligible to win Card of the Week, you just have to donate $3 or more per month, and you, too, can win this prize. Thank you so much for joining us, Adam, and being a patron of the show. It really does mean the world to me. I say that all the time, but it's because it truly and honestly does. Let's go on to our next segment, which is Power Rankings. They're brought to you by 5 Color Combo. You can check them out at 5colorcombo.com. You can download their app in the Play Store and as well as the App Store. Don't forget to check out their classic tokens that they're selling. They are amazing, beautiful, and you can go find those tokens through the link in the show notes. Thank you so much to 5 Color Combo for the sponsorship, and don't forget to check out their website. Standard, guys. We're going to talk some Standard.
Yeah, probably for the last time until rotation, because there are, I think, no more GPs and no more Standard Opens.
So let's look at... Well, we're going to do the goodbye Standard episode, right? Where,
yeah, but the last, like, kind of normal Standard power rankings, I guess.
So we have, coming in at number 5, we have Esper Control with 4 points, with a 1 top 8 by Shaheen Serrani. This deck got a lot of talk amongst myself and people who would listen to me talk about it in the last week.
I think that the deck looks pretty powerful. I do like Descend Upon the Sinful in the Standard format because it's a sweeper that, you know, can kill anything, especially things that come back like Haunted Deads and Prized Amalgams.
And Grapple with the Past, right? I mean, it...
Yeah, exactly. It kills things dead. It just gets rid of them.
Yep. Overall, the thing that I like about this is he's not doing it as much as, like, I would be doing it, and I actually have brewed some decks doing this, but Liliana plus Jace Verin's Prodigy is, like, everything Control wanted to do, I think, and it was legitimately powerful every time I've tried it.
Yeah, I mean, Liliana is very powerful, and he's playing a lot of Planeswalkers in this deck. I can't remember, was he playing... I'm sure he was playing Jaces, but how many was he playing?
He's playing 4 Jaces, 2 Lilianas.
Okay. So he is sometimes a little bit hesitant to play any creatures in his control decks because he likes his opponent's removal to be very, very bad against him.
Yeah,
but Jace is just too good to pass
up.
One
of the things that he's doing that I'm a fan of and that I've been brewing decks myself with is the Jace, Emrakul. He doesn't have it anymore, but it's been pretty good for me. I play Cooks from Blind Eternities in the main as well. And then another Emrakul in the board.
So do you think he just thought that was maybe a little bit too slow in some of his matchups and figured he would board it in the matchup so that was more...
Yeah, that could be what it was. I'm not sure. I've personally, like, I find that it's really easy to discard with Jace and just, like, get it when you want it.
Sure.
And then, like, or mill it with Liliana.
When he's playing a bunch of Oath of Jace as well,
yeah,
right?
So yeah. That's why I kept it. I would keep it in. But overall, this what he's doing with this deck, he got a soft spot in his heart for Narset, which is, I think, basically the reason that this deck is Esper, is for Narset Sorin and Descend Upon the Sinful. Otherwise, you could just probably play blue-black. But overall, I'm a huge fan of this style of control deck right now. I'm surprised he only wants 2 Lilianas, because they've been very good for me in control, and especially with Jace. It's just been great.
Yeah, I assume that it's just a number of slots thing, because, like, Emrakul is, like, not really a card you can cast in early, obviously. Jace is your only cheap threat or, like, proactive spell. Most of the deck is big mana and reactive.
Right.
So it could be that you just don't have that many slots. He didn't, like, he's playing 12 win cons, basically, which is kind of high for a control deck.
But overall, I'm a big fan of the deck. I'm a big fan of what it's doing. I think that Jace and Liliana together, they're the two best friends that nobody's going to talk about because it's not going to get a lot of press because the set's going to be gone so soon. But I think that it's a legitimate control deck, and if you wanted to play control, you should start somewhere with like that. And I myself have tested decks like this.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very powerful interaction because sometimes you discard Jaces to your Jace, sometimes they kill your Jace, things like that.
They kill your Jace a lot. They just kill it. So often you'll play your Jace on turn two, they're like, kill it, and you're like, okay, Chandra, get it back, or Liliana, get it back, and they're like... this is so fast.
It makes sense, though, because, like, you've seen Liliana kind of popping up in, like, black-white as well. So even in decks where you literally aren't playing any creatures, people are playing Liliana. So it makes Jace even better when Jace is probably already good enough to play, right? And it makes Liliana better when Liliana... They just nice synergy.
Absolutely. Coming in next, we have Haunted Dead Emerge. This is the four-color Emerge deck. And, yeah, it's... For some reason being called Sultai?
Yeah, that's what they were calling it from Star City Games. I definitely think of it as more of a four-color deck, but the red splash is very, very light. It's literally just for close electric return, and some of them basically don't even play red sources. That's just uncommon.
It just doesn't... I don't know. Sultai Emerge just doesn't sound right for it. I'm not sure why. I'm sure that it's fine. Like, I'm sure that I'll get over it. It just sounds weird.
Yeah. I agree. When I saw the word Sultai emerge together, I thought that it was some kind of new deck.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was really excited to click on it and see like what new things people were doing. Overall, I do want to say that I think that like Prize Amalgam, Haunted Dead is like something that's very powerful in the standard, and it's something that we'll want to look at moving forward. And this deck is just fine. Like,
yeah,
it's pretty good.
It does a very good job of beating up on company decks. It's a beat slow against humans, but if you can get your Kozilek's Return off, obviously it's great. But, I mean, the Prized Amalgam Haunted Dead thing is something that's even making its way into Modern. It's just a very powerful interaction.
Yeah, with this deck, I feel like this is sort of the deck for people who aren't quite ready to let go of Jace just yet, because this is the deck that I've messed around with the most, where Jace just feels really powerful.
Yeah, four times four Gather the Pack plus Jace is like...
Yeah, and grapples and stuff. You're just really good at flipping Jace like on turn three, which is a thing that hasn't happened a lot recently.
Yeah, since the fetchlands rotated, it's basically become impossible, and it was even very hard with fetchlands.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons that I really like that blue-black deck that I brewed that's playing a lot of Oath of Jace, and Liliana. Because it's like, man, this Jace, like...
Just actually flips easily.
Jace is actually just great. Sure. Similar things here. In playtesting for GP Portland, this deck was flipping its Jaces really quick.
Yeah, and I mean, like, having traverses to flashback as well as grapples. Like, you have spells that you actually want to flashback. That's, you know, the other thing a lot of the sort of styles of decks where I've seen Jace, like, in a lot of the more controlling styles, I feel like not being able to do really powerful, proactive things with Jace sort of holds it down sometimes, and in this deck, you have none of that going on.
Coming in next, we have Green Blue Crush coming in with 6 points. man, this deck is sweet. Can we just...
Yeah, I agree. It's not like... Normally some like green-blue do-nothing deck is not really my speed, but this deck is actually very exciting. It's a sweet control deck. And from what I can tell and what I've heard, it does a very good job of kind of bullying most of the slower decks in Standard, the Emerge decks, as well as like the Delirium decks, as well as being slightly favorable against Bant. So basically, if you don't expect to play against the most aggressive decks, like the Thermo Alchemist decks or the Kithian decks, this is an excellent deck to choose.
Yeah, it's also doing the whole Explosive Vegetation... Nissus Pilgrimage, like being this big ramp deck, which makes you a little like pretty favored against the Emerge decks.
Yeah, the real problem for the Emerge decks is just that Crush of Tentacles tends to be, and part of Water Veiling combination tend to be really difficult to beat. You're just really good at sort of ignoring what they're doing, like their Hold the Elder Deep Fiend stuff, just
right.
And their Kozilek's Return. Like none of that actually matters at all.
Right. But I think that Explosive Vegetation is the reason that you can do that, though.
Yeah, I just mean that I still think, like, the more kind of creatures you play, the more susceptible you are to getting Emrakul'd and still losing to that. Whereas I've seen this deck, like, get Emrakul'd and just not really care.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically they get to discard a card from your hand, usually, like, cast a ram spell and fail to find, and that's about the extent of it. Like, they just can't do that much damage with the cards you're playing. And, you know, any deck that gets to profitably play Sent to Sleep.
I knew you were going to say that.
That's just exciting. That's just good times, really.
It's two mana Frostbreath. That's everything you ever wanted.
Right, exactly. That's just good, clean magic. And, I mean, I got blown out by Sent to Sleep at GP Portland playing against this deck. It was the absolute last card that I ever would have played around, and he had two of them and just crushed me.
Yeah, I vaguely remember Sent to Sleep popping up in, like, some of the old tutelage decks at various points in time, and it's the kind of card that seems really bad until it's destroying you.
Yeah, like, you know, it doesn't feel quite the same without its old partner in crime, Majoring Bully, but it's still a respectable card. It just, like, is so dirtly.
Let's go on to the next one. We have Teamer Emerge coming in with 12 points. Teamer Emerge is, it's just a great deck. Like, legitimately, Michael Majors probably broke it. It's, like, it's really good.
Yeah, Bant Company has weirdly overshadowed it in terms of, like, play and finishes, but I think that this has probably been the best deck of this format.
I think so, too.
And, like, people may not historically remember that because of how technically dominant Bant was, but I think that if this were a longer format, by the end of it, Emerge would definitely become the more popular deck.
Agreed. It feels like it's shifted that way a little bit just in the last couple of, I mean, with this deck sort of being a thing, it's picked up steam pretty quickly. And I think it has a lot of things, too, that attract great players to it. And sometimes it takes that to really be the best deck. You know, you need the best players really. It's hard to be the best deck if the best players aren't interested in playing it, even if the deck is good.
Absolutely. I think that being a good Emrakul deck being the best Emrakul deck, I should really say, is pretty important.
It's also oddly flexible for a deck that is frequently playing three main deck Emrakuls.
Yeah, and the change to, like, not be, to change to an Emrakul deck and not a
Elder Deep Fiend.
Elder Deep Fiend deck was not something that I expected. Some people play as, you know, still a lot of them. Some of them play two. You know, it kind of just depends on the list. But overall, just impressed. Actually, I really like this list that Noah Walker played that took eighth place.
Yeah, this is kind of the style that I'm highest on also, because I think that Elder Deep Fiend still is sort of the star of the show. Even though Emrakul is the finisher, Elder Deep Fiend is really what allows you to get there.
I don't like Jace in this deck, though.
I think it's still fine. I think that with between Grapple, Vessel, and Gather, like, you're still flipping your Jaces pretty easily. And the fact that you can traverse for a land and then flashback a traverse later with Jace and cast your Emrakul, like, for a pretty minimal mana investment, I do like.
Sure.
That's pretty big. Traverse is, I mean, almost always just going to be the best card to be able to flat, right? I mean, like, it's just anything you need all the time.
Woot woot. Overall, I think that Teamer Emerge is, like Casey said, probably would have gone down as the best deck if it weren't for the next deck, you know, Bant Company coming in with 18 points, which is the most played deck by a significant margin. Interesting thing. So one of our listeners posted something, and I wanted to have the discussion because I find it to be an interesting discussion, that Bant Company won Worlds today. And it was funny because I had, right before that was posted, I had just told Casey, it's really cool that Bant Company never won a pro event. You know, it didn't win any pro tours and it didn't win Worlds. So it was interesting. Do you guys think that Bant Humans is Bant Company? They seem so different to me.
They're certainly similar. There's quite a few cards of overlap, but I do think the deck is functionally a little bit different, just because Thalia's Lieutenant, like, just makes your board so big over the course of long games.
The play patterns are different. The way you generally win are different. I mean, in the sense that they're both Bant decks playing Collected Company, and you could hypothetically both call them Bant Company. I mean, they're sort of they share a lot of cards, but I don't think the play patterns are all that similar outside of both decks having Collected Company.
Yeah, that's my thought also. It kind of reminds me of, like, Abzan and Jund right now, where, like, they're pretty different decks right now.
Sure.
Like, they share Thoughtseize and Tarmogoyf and, you know, Inquisition of Kozilek and Liliana, but outside of that, they're pretty different decks.
Yeah, they've certainly
they're structurally similar.
Yeah,
but they're like they're as divergent. The word I'm looking for from each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. They're just. I don't know. I don't think of when I think of collected company. I don't think of that deck.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're pretty similar, but they are different decks. It's not like a flavor of the deck. It's a fundamentally different deck. Banned Humans is, at least with your best draws, much more aggressive, much more of a beatdown deck, where Bant Company is more of a card advantage deck.
Yeah, I would say Bant Humans is much less of a card advantage deck and also much less of a tempo deck. Like, a lot of your plays are, you're not necessarily trying to invalidate what your opponent is doing, like, via Spell Queller or, you know, by spending mana more efficiently or whatever. You're really trying to invalidate your opponent's plays by going both wide and tall simultaneously.
Yeah, and I also think that, like, Knight of the White Orchid is something that you wouldn't dream of playing in company decks. In the... Whoa, this list is crazy!
How so?
He's playing...
Oh, he says playing Kithian? Yeah, that is interesting.
And four Thraben Inspectors and then can sideboard into Mono White, almost. Which is certainly unusual.
Holy cannoli!
That is interesting. It's also playing very few lands, right? I think most of the Bat Humans decks still play 25 lands.
25, yes, and the 10 basic planes is up there. Yeah, so...
Yeah, this deck certainly is fundamentally different.
Michael O. from the Open this weekend is... I mean, that's not even close to Bat Company.
So, are these lumped together in rankings?
No.
Or
no.
Are they split out? Okay, so Bant Humans would have been probably the next deck following Esper?
Well, we didn't use...
Or Worlds was not a...
We didn't use Worlds this week because it's two... There were only three decks played. It was Temur, Emerge, Bant Humans, and Bant Company were the only... Like,
sure.
Yeah, and it's only three decks. A three-format tournament, too. So, like, the decks that were even in the running in late in the tournament weren't necessarily the best decks...
Fair enough. No, that's totally reasonable. I'm just asking.
No, for sure. No, I think it's a good question though because I do like to explain these things.
Yeah, we also should have mentioned that Worlds wasn't being covered. Overall, I think that Bant Company it's so good. Like just watching Alex play it this week. You know, there's just. I think that you really get punished when you make mistakes against Bant Company. And I don't know that that's like necessarily true of a lot of other decks.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it's basically impossible to figure out what your opponent could have because the combination of cards, you know, in their hand plus the top six cards of their deck makes for such a nightmare scenario to play against.
Yeah. I agree with that totally, especially when you're saying, you know, you get punished for mistakes. You get punished for mistakes, but you also get punished for not actual mistakes. You get punished for bad guesses.
Yeah.
Which, like, although I guess it's sort of a mistake in the sense that you're wrong, like...
Well, sometimes it's just unlucky.
You have to guess a lot where, like, you just... There's no way you can possibly know, right? I mean, you're just, like, 50-50 to get...
Did you play Brian Bronduin's exact list, by the way?
They weren't out yet, so I was, like, three or four cards off in total, like, between main and side...
The one recruiter main is interesting to me.
Yeah, so my understanding is that they have basically stuck Tameo in slots that used to be recruiters. They're good in a lot of the same matchups.
Do you guys expect what I expect in the some kind of Tameo field researcher, reflector mage, you know, Sylvan Advocate deck will just still be good next year?
Yeah, I think it'll probably be a Tameo Gideon Sylvan Advocate deck. Yeah. Maybe Reflector Mage, depends on the format.
Tameo, I hadn't really played with Tameo yet until this weekend when I played Bant Humans, and man, that card is insane. It's like...
We were telling you that when...
Well, but actually playing it. I mean, it's like you're casting a main phase collected company that always hits two Reflector Mages or... Yeah. On an emptier board, it just draws you cards. I had it in Sealed even once, and it was really dumb there, too, where, like, you just make it so that your opponent can't really, like, ever attack you profitably.
Overall, I want to say that Bant Company is also the deck that, like, allows you to build so differently, depending on, like, what you want to do. You know, Casey has played Bounding Crisis. Alex this weekend was playing...
Rattle Chains.
Rattle Chains to protect his Spoke Quellers and his...
Selfless Spirits.
Selfless Spirits, so that, like, they couldn't get got from, like, a removal spell, this, then Sweeper. So it's just, the deck just has so much leeway and cards to choose from. When you go into, when you're one of the only, like, good three-color decks, right, that are actually three colors, right? Where, like, Teemer Emerge isn't really three colors.
Right, it's, and, right, exactly.
And, like, Bant Company, it's, like, it's a three-color deck.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah, very much so.
And part of the problem when you're playing against Bant is that even if your opponent hasn't actually made these choices, you have to, like, consider them a little bit before proceeding to get absolutely wrecked by them if they're doing anything unusual.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like, you know, so you're thinking, okay, well, I guess my opponent could play Rattle Chains or Bounding Crisis or Ojutai's Command or Jamoga's Command or Collected Company or Spell Queller or, yep. You know, it's like, well, we've only listed off, yeah, like, 15 cards. Yeah, you have to play around
so many things at once. It can make... That's what I mean when I'm saying, like, you just get punished by mistakes. But at the same time, it's like Michael said, it's like, well, it wasn't really a mistake. I just happened to have, like, this combination of three cards instead.
Right. It just lined up real bad is how... Like, most games that I've lost against Bant Company, I walk away thinking, I mean, I guess I could have played that better, but I don't know that it actually would have been better. It just would have worked out better.
Yeah, well, I mean, you also have, like, the Reflector Mage Spell Queller dance where it's like, okay, my opponent's casting a 3-drop creature. Do I Company now, or do I wait for it to resolve?
Right.
And, like, it's such a, like, it's literally a coin flip. If you haven't seen any of either, you got 4 of each in your deck, who knows where this is going to go.
Just on that note, one of the things I do like better about Bant Humans is that because you're playing both Thalia and... Or one of the things I didn't like about Bant Humans, rather, is that you're playing Thalia and Reflector Mage, and you still have that same tension. You know, so you think, oh, I'm cutting Spell Queller, and you're, you know, okay, this isn't going to be a thing that happens anymore. And then you, you know, go to cast a Company when your opponent plays Ishkanah. I mean, I guess for Ishkanah, you're probably trying to hit Thalia. But there are plenty of creatures where you're thinking, okay, what do I need to happen? And then you realize you have the same conundrum that you have always had. It's just like you can't get away from it.
It's inescapable. And also, I guess it's kind of nice in that maybe it's not technically Bant Company that got to win Worlds this week, but this, in a sense, was like the Bant Collected Company deck's chance to walk down the aisle instead of always being the bridesmaid, right?
Yeah.
Because it always got snubbed out by just decks that were just better than it the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that while the Bant Humans deck, I think, is slightly favored in the mirror match of the two decks, like... When you have the Bant Company versus Bant Company variant in the finals of Worlds, it's sort of fitting for how dominant the deck has really been throughout this standard format.
Yeah, BBD actually said this morning that he thought that Bant Company Classic, I guess, was favored in the mirror by quite a bit.
Interesting. That hasn't been my experience, but I could certainly be wrong.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I know that in the past... Like, before Shadows, Bant Company was favored over Bant Humans. But I think Spell Queller is kind of an awkward card in the mirror, in the pseudo-mirror.
It is.
So I could see it being kind of less powerful because you cut cards that affect combat for Spell Queller, which doesn't.
Spell Queller I found to be pretty bad, actually, in the mirror, because you have to telegraph it so hard most of the time that it ends up being pretty easy to play around. And you end up in this situation where you're basically playing... You know, what's ostensibly, you know, super Mystic Snake, but ends up feeling a lot more like a really poor man's Bounding Crisis.
Yeah, and also, like, the problem is Spell Queller is very good at helping you stay ahead, but sometimes the dominoes really fall.
Especially playing against the human version where you have, like, if they have a Thalia in play, you'll run into all these issues where, like, your Collected Companies now only have Reflector Mage as targets to affect combat. If they start playing Thalia's Lieutenants, you know, their mid-combat companies are a lot more powerful than yours. If the Bant Humans deck mid-combat company is more powerful than the standard Bant Company when you're in the middle of combat, because you just have more stuff to hit.
Yeah,
that changes math.
Exactly. Your mid-combat companies are much more powerful with humans. That's certainly, I think, kind of the selling point of the deck. That, and you do still have the Lamholt Pacifist, like, beatdown draws that green-white had.
Yeah.
Which can just, like, there are just a lot of decks that just can't beat that.
Well, and you can do things, too, like, where your opponent, I would say, where Bant Company sometimes struggles to really pass completely, Bant Humans between... You know, some number of Duskwatch Recruiters, always the full four Tireless Trackers, and then, you know, being able to pass with your Lamholt Pacifist. I felt in that matchup like I was able to pass where I wasn't feeling like I was time walking myself as much as I did when I was trying to do the same thing in Bant Company Mirrors.
Yeah, definitely.
Where
yeah.
like there was a I was watching. I think it was a game that BBD ended up winning against Carvalho earlier this afternoon, where Carvalho had like triple Spell Queller or something, but it was actually actively bad because he kept having to hold up mana, and then like it was you know so BBD plunked down a couple of creatures, whatever, got slightly ahead on board. And then Carvalho's in this spot where he's either casting 2/3 flying flashes for 3 while BBD then lets it resolve in companies, or he's just not casting anything. And it's like, I mean, I understand Spellqueller is powerful, but like it's for a card so powerful, it can like become oddly awkward.
Yeah, it's sort of a blunt instrument is how I like to refer to cards like that, where like it's kind of, it's powerful, but it's fairly easy to play around. For the most part, like, especially if you are playing instant and flash cards in your own deck.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you kind of really, you can just force your opponent to cast it for minimal value.
Right. And
or just do nothing.
It's the minimal value case is actually terrible. Right? I mean, like a 3-mana 2/3 is really bad in that matchup.
Yeah. Well, just in general, like, Windrake isn't quite good enough for standard. This card's a little bit better than that, but not much.
Right. And, I mean, the other thing is that the human company deck is such a good beatdown deck that, like, if you get caught in that position, it just gets ugly really quick. There's just not, like, you're just not going to beat them with 2/3 flyings. You know?
Yeah. I mean, they get values of tenants that are 10/10s, right? So.
Yeah. It's a very odd matchup, frankly. It's a little bit hard to figure out who exactly is favored sometimes when you're playing these matchups, because I feel like they swing so much on experience and play skill and sequencing, just because the decks are so similar, that you have a lot of games that are ended because one player just draws so much better, and then you have a lot of games that, you know, the better player seems to be winning over and over and over again, and it's hard to tell, like,
kind of where they picked up that equity.
Yeah, just like why a player is winning.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that isn't always incredibly intuitive, because it's definitely more than any other matchup from standard in quite some time, is that this is a very, like, inches or even centimeters matchup, where if you have a collected company, making the correct choice of two creatures is so pivotal. And sometimes even the better creature isn't necessarily the one that you want to take.
Definitely. I definitely had some times over the weekend where I was a little bit unsure about what creature to take. The flip side, though, is that I would say you also get more hands with the human version, where it, like, actually just doesn't matter what you do. You basically can't possibly mess it up, because you end up, like, you know, playing out a bunch of creatures, and then you collect a company and a double Thalia's Lieutenant. You're just like, okay, great, this game is over. And although, like, the normal version of company is obviously powerful, there's no, like, sort of get-out-of-the-jail-free cards, where I would say, like, Thalia's Lieutenant, in a lot of board states, multiples are just actually unbeatable.
Yeah. I mean, the Bant Humans deck definitely has the beatdown draw that is just a faster clock than anything Bant Company can put up. Mostly, it's going to come down to the same haymakers in the mirror. It's going to come down to your Avacyns, your Tragic Arrogances, your Tameos, things like that, to really close the gap. And, you know, if we watched Worlds this weekend, you saw a lot of that in those any matchups. Like, the advantage, and so it's possible that the advantage does kind of go to humans, because you can win games before they get to that point where the other side you really can't. But I think when you get there, it's pretty close. Like, so in the early game, humans is very favored.
Definitely.
In the very late game, when you're drawing those haymakers, it's literally just whoever draws them is a huge favorite to win. In the intermediate, I think that Bant Classic will pull ahead little by little, but it's really just a matter of when the big guns show up.
Yeah, my experience with Bant Company has been that you're better in the matchups against removal spells, because you're better at generating card advantage, but that in, like, the mirror match, a lot of the time, your mana ends up being taxed so much because you just have to cast things all the time, and there's so much pressure to sort of get things on the board in the early turns, that, like, marginally better sort of card filtering, like, you're probably playing more recruiters in
typically
normal Bant Company than you would be in humans, but a lot of the time it's hard to get to the part of the game where that's what the game is about. like you just have so many more cards in sort of the early to early mid part of the game where you have to dodge these that I just feel like it's more awkward from the Bant side.
Yeah, that could be a good way to put it. It's a very peculiar matchup. I could see a lot of people having different opinions just based on the way that it's shaken out for them in the past.
Yeah.
Because it's such a matchup with so many moving parts.
Definitely.
That, like, so many things can go right or wrong from either side that it could be a much, much closer matchup than kind of anybody that's on the fringes gives it credit for.
That makes sense to me. I was really impressed playing Bant this weekend just at how many, like, great sideboard cards I got to play. It was shocking to me how good my sideboard was compared to, like, any other deck I've played recently.
Yeah, and a lot of the other decks, you have very rigid sideboards because you need to sideboard for Bant so much.
Right.
That when you're playing Bant, you don't really have that as much of a burden. You have a lot more flexibility, and you can play cards that are good against Bant, but also are good in other matchups.
All right, let's move on to the everybody's favorite part of the show, the Training Grounds. The Training Grounds are brought to you by Oasis Games. You can check them out at oasisgamesslc.com. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. And you can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood, no spaces. This week, we're talking about playing your counter spells. This is something that we've talked about doing for a long time. Doing this podcast, and it's the one that won the Patreon vote. So if you want to be able to vote on one Training Grounds, you know, every 8 episodes or so, go to patreon.com/ccmtg and become a patron of the show, starting at $1, and you can do it too. But yeah, let's do this. So Casey wrote, "Know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run."
I didn't write all of that, but I feel like it was implied. But specifically, when to hold them. Like, so, counterspells, people who are kind of new to playing counterspells, playing control decks, they have a tendency to just jam counterspells. Where you're like, I'm trying to think what, like,
no, I
grapple with the past,
I understand,
or like
this.
Void Shatter.
But it has to do, like, because I've certainly had this experience before, both I've done this and had it done against me. I think it comes down to, like, a lot of decks. You're really worried about mana efficiency, and if you're playing like a Bant Company Mirror, right? You're like, well, if I don't spend this mana now, I'm never going to get it back.
Yeah, and which is just not an attitude you can have with a control deck because your cards typically hit harder on average. So you
at least at the top end, right?
Right, like at least like a counterspell is a better card than Grapple with the Past. So you need to not trade so far down on card quality.
Right, I mean, if that Grapple with the Past is really an Emrakul, then sure. But, like, it's understanding sort of, you know, if someone says Lava Spike, you probably don't want to, you know, Cryptic Command.
Yeah, unless you're at 3, in which case, you know, you probably should. Sure. But, yeah, in general, that's kind of the idea that I'm trying to get across here, that sometimes you just slow down a little bit on the counterspells, make sure that you're saving it for the cards that you boarded in your counterspells for, or that you have counterspells in your deck for.
Yeah, it makes sense. Like, just that even if it means sometimes spending your mana inefficiently, the ability to hit more land drops typically in the decks that are playing a bunch of counterspells as the game goes on, the ability to, you know, find something that's difficult to interact with to win the game, sort of you have an advantage typically in a control deck the longer the game goes, and you can't end it any faster by countering, you know, by trying to counter every spell your opponent plays. So if it, you know, you have to look at sort of like board impact and what is this spell really going
to
do?
Yeah, another thing to think about, I think the thing that taught me the most about when to hold and when to counter things was back when Mana Leak was printed. And we had Lotus Cobra and Cultivate and stuff like, and we had these ramp decks like Volokut and Kessel Wolfram back in back-to-back years, these Primeval Titan decks. And I think that I learned a lot about countering spells back then, both playing with and against counter spells. You know, I got the chance to play a lot of, like, blue-white control before Cobblade, and then play a ton of Cobblade. And, you know, if that's, it's pretty important to know what you should be doing. You know, a lot of people, are, you know, talking about what Casey's talking about here, So you would think that because Casey's saying don't counter that grapple, that, okay, so I should also save my counter spells for their world breakers and their, you know, their, or their Ulamogs or their Emrakuls. And it's like, well, actually, no, you should actually be countering things like, you know, Nissa's Pilgrimage and...
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. It's definitely matchup dependent. So it's more know what cards to counter in the matchup.
Exactly.
And like against that red-green Balakid deck that you were describing, that's actually a good example because that deck had Summoner's Trap, right?
It did, yeah.
So that's a deck where, like, typically, oh, Lotus Cobra, that's a really powerful card.
Actually, you're about to say something that's great. You actually are supposed to counter the Lotus Cobra.
You think
you're supposed to, yeah. So I didn't think so, but it was common consensus among pros that if they have the trap, they have the trap, but you're going to lose to that Cobra anyway.
Fair enough. You learn new things every day.
So I think this is particularly interesting when we're talking about Mana Leak or Spell Snare or Spell Pierce, spells that don't necessarily scale especially well, I mean, for different reasons in this case, but spells where, like, you might say, oh, I don't want to counter everything, but there's sort of the chance of not getting to counter anything at all with it if you wait too long.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of spells that are like that where you kind of, it does just depend, right? Not every counter spell is created equally.
Yeah.
And they all have different, like, Cryptic Command is, you know, one of the most powerful counter spells because it has so much other, you gain so much more out of it, whether it's just drawing a card or whether it's time walking them by tapping their team at the same time, like, you can't just blow your Cryptic Commands willy-nilly, but some other smaller, more conditional counter spells, you kind of need to take what you can get.
Right, and I think that's pretty interesting, and when you're talking about Cryptic Command, it's also the kind of card that it might be a card that you think is good in the matchup, but you might need to fire it off to draw. Or if you have a Condescend, you might need to fire it off because you need to scry to, you know, continue to hit land drops. So there's a lot that goes into, like, deciding which cards you should be casting sort of at earliest opportunity, both based on the matchup, the game state, and just, you know, your own deck.
Yeah, next up we have when to counter everything. So, like, in what matchups or in what situations should you just be point and click?
So I think that if you're playing, like, Delver and Legacy, that's a good example where, one, you're playing a lot of counter spells, and two, you basically can't beat any permanents or cards of any kind out of your opponent, like, on the board. So you basically, you Spell Pierce, you Force of Will, you Daze, you just try not to play against anything, stifle their lands, wasteland them. So it's a very much like a turbo counter spell deck where you just want everything out of the way. Where if you're playing, like you said, like a control deck, a drag out like Miracles, right, for example, you don't want to counter all of their creatures because you have Terminus and Swords of Plowshares for that. And countering a Tarmogoyf, like, it can be a waste of that resource.
Right. If you have a Terminus in your top three and the ability to Miracle it, you know, at instant speed or whatever, it seems sort of silly to spend a counterspell on it.
I think Delver is probably the perfect example of this. Like, when you think about the way you used your Mana Leaks with Delver, it was
against Spell?
Yeah.
Spell, Mana Leak.
Yeah. It was Delver, Mana Leak, Mana Leak, Mana Leak. You're dead.
Yeah, that's certainly the dream. That was plan A for sure.
Yeah. And it's a thing that's kind of beautiful in a way. Spell Pierce is in a similar space where it's like you're going to point and click your Spell Pierce at basically every relevant spell that they cast, because you're gaining equity in your mana and stuff like that. And that's what a huge part of what Mana Leak and actual counterspell have going for them, is that the reason that you're so okay to point and click in those style of decks is because you're operating on margins, and you're gaining a lot through those margins.
Right. It starts feeling close to Time Walk. Like,
right,
when you're trading one mana for four of theirs, and you got to spend your other three mana advancing your board or whatever, that's when those are especially powerful.
Well, and yeah, also just kind of the decay of some of those spells, right? Mana Leaking a turn, or a mana like a Primeval Titan when they have exactly six lands in play is awesome. Mana Leaking a Primeval Titan when they have 10 lands in play kind of doesn't do anything.
Right.
So you have to be a little bit careful, right, about getting stuck with a bunch of Mana Leaks when your opponent starts to get 8, 9, 10 lands in play.
This is actually a great transition to the next point, which is the must counter spells. When you think about, like, Volokut decks at large or the Wolfrun decks, the reason that the ramp spells were the must counter spells is exactly what these guys are talking about, where, like, it's like, all right, I'm just going to wait to counter their Titan. It's like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep casting ramp spells, and now you can't counter any spells.
Yeah, and also, like, things just get bad for you. You might, like, by letting the cultivate or whatever the ramp spell is resolve, you are getting into a stage of the game where they have so many haymakers, where you may not have enough counterspells to go around. But if you can keep them trapped in the mid-game,
right,
then you can let those cards just decay in their hand while you're beating them down.
Right, you can find something more powerful to do before they can really deploy the stuff that's going to kill you.
Yeah, and this doesn't have to be true. I mean, Delver and Cobblade did a good job of showing this because they had these 1-2 drops that they played to like make it so. But even when you think about things like blue-black control against things like green-red devotion, for example, you know, you still wanted to counter their ramp creatures.
Well, and a lot of the time, these cards don't really, like, not all the value is in the body, right? Like, if someone casts an Ulamog, you're sort of, I mean, it's better to counter it than not to counter it, presumably, but it's not great, right? I mean, you're not thrilled that now you only cast double Vindicate.
Yeah, well, yeah, Worldbreaker and Ulamog are great examples where, like, okay, so I countered your Worldbreaker, but you sacrificed a Sanctum to get another Worldbreaker, and you blew up a land.
Yeah.
So kind of nothing just happened for me.
When you look back on things like Esper Control, you know, the Sphinx's Revelation Esper Control deck, or even the Blue-Black Control deck with
Dissipate?
No, not Dissipate. It was... what was the one that scryed one?
Dissolve.
Dissolve. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, when you think about like the Dissolve Heroes Downfall deck or the Dissolve Heroes Downfall Sphinx of Revelation
Elixir Immortality.
Well, no, I'm trying to think of what the enchantment was that was an O-ring for everything.
Detention Sphere.
So when you think about those decks, you know, one thing to think about is when am I supposed to dissolve it versus Heroes Downfall it versus, you know, whatever it is that I need to do. And oftentimes the correct choice is if it's a creature, you should let it resolve and downfall it.
Yeah, that was definitely a deck where you were encouraged to let things through. Like, you wanted to get them to play as much into the Supreme Verdict and the Elspeth and whatever else as possible. Yeah. So you didn't want to necessarily counter things early very often at all. Like, a turn 3 dissolve, most of the time you wouldn't really want to involve yourself in unless it was something like an Underworld Connections.
Yeah, and the other thing to think about is, like the Syncopate version of the deck that was, like, Syncopate, I forgot the name again.
Dissolve.
Syncopate, Dissolve, Sphinx's Revelation deck, like, that deck was the same way, right? Where you would syncopate basically everything early, but you would hold those dissolves till the bitter end.
You'd have to pry them out of my hands, yeah.
Yeah.
Where syncopate, like, again, it's like Spell Pierce, where it just doesn't age very well.
Yeah.
Like, if they're only spending half their mana, like, this 7-mana counterspell may not be very good, because they may have another follow-up spell.
Yeah, and that brings us to our next point, which is not taking bait. You know, so often, I mean, I'm going to say something that I've never said on this podcast, and I think that it's very true. If you want to know what separates, you know, decent players from good players, not good to great, if you want to go from, you know, somebody who goes, you know, X2 at their FNM and occasionally wins one, somebody who is constantly winning their FNM, topping a lot of PPDQs, you know, has a shot to like get to the Pro Tour for the first time. This is the thing that separates them, and that's learning how to sequence your spells so to optimize your opponent making a misplay against you, as well as learning not to fall for it when your opponent's doing that.
Yeah, like so. There's a kind of a classic one in Standard right now that I've seen a bunch of people get got by. So let's say you're at 6 life, and I cast I'm blanking on the name of cards. The Searing Spear that's at Sorcery, that's in Standard right now.
Incendiary Flow.
I Incendiary Flow you. So conventional wisdom would say you should save your counterspell for the next burn spell or whatever they're going to use to finish you off. But because in Standard, a lot of times it's going to be Exquisite Firecraft, you will straight lose if you do that. So they're kind of offering up this kind of the opposite of a bait. They're saying, okay, you know, here's the first burn spell, the one you don't need to counter, and then they just kill you because you were greedy.
Yeah. Right. This happens a lot with Spell Queller, too, for what it's worth. Like, there's a really fine line.
That's what I was thinking of, there's the number really of people that misplay their Spell Quellers against me.
Well, against you, but it's also hard to play against, right? You sort of have to, like, you don't want to just time walk yourself, but I found a lot of the time, like, playing against Bant with the Teemer deck, I would be trying to just pass on turn three to try to see if I could get them to just play it for no value, or to play a spell an instant on their turn, or to like lead on a traverse that I could trap under a spell queller because I didn't actually need the land. So I would like pretend, you know, I would go like turn one forest, turn two island, turn three cast traverse before playing a land, but I really want to resolve a grapple or something like that. So
right.
There's a lot of stuff where like if you can make your opponent misjudge the importance of a spell, it's really powerful for you. And if you're misjudging the importance of your opponent's spells, if you're not understanding like what is going to be backbreaking versus what is not, you can spend counterspells in ways where they just are not effective.
Yeah, exactly. And Traverse is actually a really good example with Spell Queller too, because it's maybe is not that good right now, but it's going to be really good right. later.
So the odd thing is that a lot of the time in doing so, you would actually like sort of supercharge your Traverse, right? In that it could get the Spell Queller out of their hand, but when I flash back a Kozilek's Return later, I'm not going to get a land. I'm going to get, you know, Ishkana or something like that. And I think that kind of stuff is really hard to play. Like, it's hard to figure out for sure, but if you can get better at doing that, at understanding both how to bait your opponents into it and how to, you know, figure out when your opponent is messing with you versus when this is really all they have.
Yeah.
So it's a big step to improvement.
It is. And I think that and that's why I said, I think that it's the thing that separates people. If you think about like the misplays that these are game defining misplays.
Yeah. And sometimes not obviously game-defining misplays, right? You counter a spell because it seems good. You know, like, there are times where maybe you're getting into kind of the late game and they cast a Sylvan Advocate because you're like, oh, man, that's going to make their Lumbering Falls big and it's going to be kind of problematic for me. I think I should counter this. And then they play a Collected Company and you're like, I'm the stupidest person alive.
Well, yeah. And I think that it happens a lot. I would say that it's funny. I love playing against like just good old control decks with mid-range decks. And the reason is because of this game. This very intricate, fun mind game that I love to play. Honestly, it's won me so many more matches than a lot of other things have in my Magic career, is knowing how to sequence my spells correctly against counter spells. And on the flip side, knowing what's important and when to counter it, because it's going to be individualized by matchup, but also you have to think, like, why are they sequencing this here?
So where would you say you see people make the most mistakes in terms... Do you think people make more mistakes by being too patient with counterspells or by trying to get, like, play them too quickly?
I think that it depends on the person a lot of the time. I will say I think we did an episode on like fighting over.
Yeah. Kind stuff. Of knowing what matters, something yeah. in that vein.
And I think that a lot of times people will get to the point where they're, I think people get afraid that this spell is going to rot in their hands and they left that mana and they have to use that mana.
Yeah. And another one is people countering just good cards, right? Like, we get into a stage of the game where I'm casting a Tarmogoyf. Maybe the Tarmogoyf doesn't really matter, but Tarmogoyf's a good card, so people will want to just counter Tarmogoyf. And then you're like, okay, well, here's what really matters. Like, this is what this game is about now, because you spent your counter spell on a Tarmogoyf that ultimately wasn't really going to impact the clock or wasn't going to impact the game in a meaningful way.
Yeah, a good example of that is actually probably something like Rug Twin, where, like, you were caught at both ends, but, like, at the end of the day, you needed to ignore that Tarmogoyf.
Yeah,
especially... You needed to make the game not about the Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, exactly. Find some other way other than tapping out with when your opponent is on 3 mana on your return to deal with the Tarmogoyf. Yeah, people did it all the time.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you're playing, like, the Jund Mirror, for example, if I play a Tarmogoyf, you have the opportunity to play a Liliana and Edict it away, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
But if you do that against Tarmotwin, you lost the game.
Yeah.
That's all that happened there.
Yeah, I think in general people tend to be, I would agree in that, I think people are typically a little bit too quick to sort of try to slam counterspells into things, and that a lot of the time if you just present them with an opportunity to make a mistake, they will just walk right into it.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's talk about some specific counter spells. We talked a little bit about Mana Leak already. Let's talk about some others. So we have cards. The most overrated card in Magic. Actually, I'm gonna just throw that Force of Will.
I mean, that's possibly true, but it's also, it's iconic, and it has, because its downside is fairly crippling, like it costs you two cards to counter a spell.
It's probably not the, well, it could be the most overrated card. I'm not
overrated,
sure if it's hyperbole a lot.
Necessary?
Yeah, it's like a necessary evil that people think is good.
Yeah, I mean, like, discarding a card, or exiling a card, not even discarding, exiling a card to pay for Force of Will is a pretty high price.
Yeah.
But, you know, getting belchered on your opponent's first turn is an even higher price.
Yeah.
So, you play it, but it's also a card that people are very conservative with for that reason.
Yeah, one thing that you, when I think about the Force of Will, I think about a few different decks that would play it. And so when you think about Force of Will, here's the way that I like to think about the card. You have decks that play it like Delver and Merfolk are examples of one style of deck that plays it.
Yeah, where if like, oh, my opponent played a spell, Force of Will.
Yeah, you have decks like Miracles that play it, where it's like, no, you can't do that. That's not okay, Storm and Belcher. And then you have decks that play it as a literal necessary evil, as in they wish that they could not play this card 100% of the time. And that's decks like Shardless Bug.
Yeah,
or where it's like, I don't want this at all.
Infect too. Like it's
Infect is another perfect example where
it's so bad in the deck, but like you just have to play it to beat Force
of Will. Both of those decks have also been known sometimes not to play four of them. In fact, for a long time, Shardless Bug played zero.
Yeah, you just played them in the sideboard, and then people like got a little storm happy, and then you're like, okay, well, I guess we're back to paying the main deck's tax for that.
And the thing is that sometimes price of a card makes you think that, like, it's like when people say things like, it's the best counterspell ever, I'm like, that's not even a little true.
Right, because that's Spell Pierce, but nobody talks about that.
Because that's Mana Drain, but it's so much better than everything else
Mana Drain is more powerful, certainly, but like...
No, I mean, it's actually better, too.
It's better, and it's banned in Legacy, right? So
that's true. I think that Spell Pierce... Well, maybe Spell Pierce doesn't really see that much play in Vintage because of like how much mana everybody has.
Yeah, Mana Drain is just hugely format warping.
Anyway,
not really here or there.
Yeah, but the thing that I want to think about with Force of Will is like, why do all of these decks play it, and versus what is the card doing in each of those decks?
Yeah, and I think people kind of have different opinion. Like the mistakes people make with counterspells go really far on both sides with this card because people just want to counter everything because it's free. Or they say, oh, I have to exile a card from my hand to play this card. I have to be really selective about what I'm countering. Where Legacy is such a fast format that you really need to be sure before you make a decision one way or the other.
It depends a lot on the matchup, right? I mean, I certainly know that in some of the fairer matchups, like playing Miracles, I would frequently board some number of Force of Wills out. Like, you frequently have to keep some number in the deck, but you it's not an effect you like want to draw the second Force of Will.
I think Jerry Thompson either wrote an article or talked about it on our old podcast. He might have just talked about it on Brain Tapped, that Force of Will is a card that people don't board out enough, kind of like Lightning Bolt and Jund. It's like, no, you need this card's not good, like just board it out, and people are like, no, it's like the best card in my deck. It's like,
so that's true, but not in every matchup.
Right, right. It's very polarized in value, right? When you're playing Charbelcher, you're really, really happy you have Force Will. Just like when you're playing Infect, you're really happy you have Lightning Bolt, right? It's great, but...
Exactly.
And also, like, for example, in Delver, you should basically never board out your Force Wills. But in Miracles, you should be boarding out your Force of Wills anytime you're not playing against combo.
Yeah, the thing that I was thinking about the Shardless is, like, I think they're usually the first card they go to. Do I need this? Nope. Okay, it's out. And that's just not true of some of the other cards that we're going to talk about. So the next card that I want to talk about that he's put down is Remand.
Yeah, and that's for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's probably the card I've seen misplayed more often than any other card in Magic. Two, people are really confused as to when they're supposed to use it and what it does. So it has a couple of modes. One of them is a very tempo-positive card. Your opponent casts a spell, you put it back in their hand, you replace it. You're keeping their board clean, and you're not falling behind.
Getting mana advantage,
right?
Right, and then you draw a second one, and they concede.
Right. Yeah, that's plan A. But also, it has modes where, for example, if I cast a lightning bolt at you and you're at 3 life and you cast a remand because you just need to draw a card so that like you can try to find an answer to this lightning bolt, and then people will remand your remand, but really I should be remanding my lightning bolt so that way you don't get to draw a card off of your remand.
Right.
And it's a kind of a counterintuitive play to counter your own spells, but that's actually why remand is so good.
Yeah.
Is that's kind of like the best mode of remand that nobody ever uses.
Yeah, the other thing that remand does that people don't look at is when there are additional costs being paid.
Oh yeah, if you get to remand like a lightning axe or something like that, like that type of effect where it's like, this is a huge blowout.
Collective brutality, for example.
Sure.
Yeah, our card of the week.
Yeah, if you're, yeah, exactly. If somebody discards two cards to their collective brutality and you remand it, you probably just won the game.
Yeah, you just cast a 2-mana ancestral recall. It was really powerful.
Yeah. And although, like tap down some of your opponent's mana with it.
Yeah, we're also a little bit unsure as to why they're casting collective brutality with all three modes against the remand deck. But
cuz they're killing a Delver.
Yeah, okay. They're killing Delver and they are at low life cuz we bolted them cuz we're playing red. And other things.
It's a thing that happened.
3-mana counter spell that they think I have.
Yeah, and they're trying to get the electrolyze out of my hand. Everybody knows that. But in all honesty, remand is also it's very similar to Mana Leak in the fact that the main goal of the card is really to get mana advantage. Counter spell, like luckily, and the one of the reasons that you'll so often see some number of split between remand and Mana Leak is because it's a scalable thing, right? So while in standard against those decks that we talked about, Mana Leak became dead if you didn't counter their ramp spells. In modern, you don't usually get to enough mana outside of Jund in long grindy games that Mana Leak just isn't a hard counter.
Yeah, Mana Leak is counter spell in modern most of the time, but remand is close enough to counter spell most of the time in certain decks, like in Splinter Twin. Because the idea was that the matchup wasn't, or the game wasn't going to go very long.
Yeah,
so
it's one of those things, once again, where it's about something, right?
Yeah.
The game is about this, so this is the counter spell that I want to play, which we could do a whole other podcast on what counter spells you should play and why in which decks. When you think about, like, back in the day, it's back in the day being 2 years ago, instead of playing Dissolve in Bug Control, in Soultide Control, they actually played Syncopate or Clash of Will, it was one of the two. Over that in all the time, and it was because they'd rather have the scalable spell and not have to have a double blue spell in their deck. So there's all kinds of deck building costs and things like that can go into your counter spells, and also like it's about what's important, right? I can play Mana Leak in the slot of my remands in Delver or in Splinter Twin, but like why
exactly? Because in
the game's gonna end before you get to cast that spell again anyway,
right? Because in modern, like, curving out is so important, right? That Tarmogoyf that I countered on turn 2 with remand is probably gonna sit on the shelf for a little while because you're going to want to cast a Lingering Souls or a Liliana on your next turn, so it's effectively a hard counter if I don't think the game is going to go very long.
Right, and I mean that's why you typically see remand in like tempo, you know, aggro control decks as opposed to like hard control decks.
Yeah, if I'm playing Cruel Ultimatum, I'm probably not playing remand because that's not really the type of like
right
that card does not synergize with that deck.
Right, bounce your Tarmogoyf, recast it next turn when I'm trying to cast an 8 mana sorcery or whatever.
These aren't on the list, but I'd like to talk about them. And we can talk about them in a clump. We have Cancel, Negate, and Essence Scatter effects. Like, when do you use those spells? When do you board them in? What are you trying to counter with them? Like, what's the reason for those?
Well, yeah, I mean, it obviously depends on the deck, the format, the matchup, whatever. But especially if it's something that you're boarding in, you need to have a really specific plan in mind. Like, it's very tempting to, for example, right now in Standard, use your negates to counter Dromoka's commands against Spant Company. But you have to be really sure that that's what you want to be in that game because you really need to be able to counter collected companies.
Or, probably at this point, Tamiyo's.
Yeah, both. Like, the Haymakers, right? Like, Dromoka's command is a good card, and a removal spell is powerful and sometimes it's worth countering. But you have to make sure that you have enough counter spells to make that kind of thing worth it. And also, it's sort of funny, but typically you want to use your least mana efficient card you have access to so that in the future you can have as much leeway as possible, right? Like, if you have the, theoretically, if you had the option and they were both live, you'd want to murder something rather than Doomblade it if you had the option. So that way, your removal spell
only takes 2 mana. You have to have a reason for that, but yeah.
Yeah, but assuming that your opponent is playing mono white or four color non black.
Yeah, right? A good thing to think about this, we kind of talked about the Esper deck. That deck played, like, it played Dissolve, it played some number of, you know, Syncopates, it played Distension Sphere, it played Hero's Downfall, and Ultimate Price, right? The deck played, or Devour Flesh in some cases, I think it ended up playing, but it's like this very wide net of spells that Control hasn't seen since then, but the, like, sequencing was so important, and that's kind of what Tase is talking about, yeah.
I think with removal spells, it's very important to work them from least mana efficient to most. In counter spells, it's typically the other way around.
Interesting.
Because you need to save your dissolves oftentimes because you don't know exactly what your opponent's next threat or next card you need to counter is going to be.
So you're trying to scale for most conditional to least conditional rather than always worrying about.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of what we talked about before with that Esper deck, right? Where it's like, I'm gonna let this thing resolve, right? Because I'd rather have this dissolve later.
And that's also, so in this case, you're also talking about having some sort of combination of, like, if your opponent is going to have enchantment removal of some kind, you don't want to trap their most powerful thing under the detention sphere, right?
Yeah.
It's about conditionality, right? Like, if you have things, where are you minimizing downsides, basically?
Yeah. The other thing to think about, you know, when you look at counterspells and when to counter something, how to counter something, you know, and building your deck with counterspells, a huge, huge thing that, like, when you look at, like, deciding between, even in modern, Dispel versus Negate versus Counterflux versus the black blue one versus, you know,
Counter Squall.
Yeah, versus Counter Squall. Like, there are reasons for things, right? And the important thing to know about when to counterspell is to have a reason for it. Dispel is a good example of this. When I play Rogue Scapeshift, I don't play dispels. Like, I'm not. That's not in the deck's range, right? But when I play Grixis Control, I might play a Dispel over a Negate in the sideboard. And the reason is because of I have a reason that I want that, right? I want to improve my burn matchup, and a lot of the times the things that I'm fighting over with Negates in that deck are similar to the things that I would and are similar to Negate. And I can also counter burn spells with it, yeah, at a very good price.
Well, and sometimes, like, it also depends on, like, the more blue the format is, the more counterspell wars you're getting into, the more dispels you want.
Exactly.
Because it's mana efficient.
Yep. And also in Scapeshift, for example, instead of playing something like Dispel or Negate, the technology that Matt Kling and I adopted a long time ago that I never gave up on...
Was Giga Drowse.
Because it did this... It countered, you know... 3 counter spells at once.
Yeah, just being able to... Yeah, it functioned like a counter spell, even though it doesn't read like one.
Yeah, it's just a counter spell that you cast before your spell.
Yeah, like a silence, well, basically.
For a long time, for example, those decks were actually playing guttural response in that slot before Matt Kling and I started playing Giga Drowse.
Oh, sure. That's the green-red hybrid.
Yes.
Basically dispel for blue instance only, right?
Yes. I think it's actually just... Is it just blue spells?
I don't know.
Yeah, we used to play Giga Drowse back in the day, actually, in Standard as the same thing.
I feel like if Guttural Response can counter Ponder, that's a weird... Yeah, blue counter target blue instance.
Spell. Okay, cool.
There you go. It would probably be a lot better if it could counter Ponder.
Yeah, it would. Honestly, that would be weird, because it's like... I feel like that's not what that card does.
But then the last spell that we should talk about, and something that Casey, I think... It kind of talks about the scaling thing and the point and click thing is Daze.
Yeah. Cast them. Seriously, if your opponent casts a spell into Daze, Daze it.
Daze is the counter everything spell, right? It's, yeah. You just have to take what you can get.
Yeah, this is the counter spell that ages so poorly. Like, it's, you know, 4 spike or mana tithe play in a similar space. If you are a psychopath and play either of those cards.
No, there was a deck the other day that somebody asked me my feedback, and I was like, I feel like this is the first modern deck that I've seen that really does want mana type.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it, like, in the Hate Bears deck, where you're already taxing their mana pretty heavily.
Oh, man, that's not the deck that I was thinking of, but that would be, like, the most tilting thing if that happened to me.
Yeah, again, I don't think it would be that good, but I could see it being powerful. But just Daze their spell. It doesn't... It honestly... It does. If it's Mishra's bauble, daze it. It doesn't matter. Daze it.
They cast their Mishra's bauble with no open mana.
Seriously, just daze their spells.
Also, we're in a weird format where Mishra's baubles are seen play against dazes.
Mana less dredge. Plays Mishra's bauble.
I said it weird. Weird format. All right. So at the end of the day, I think the thing to remember is it's about having reasons to do things, just like most things in Magic. But also, you know, make sure you understand why your opponents are sequencing things the way that they're sequencing them. Because if you got, you're going to get caught with your pants down if you don't. And nobody wants to be caught with their pants down. That's embarrassing for everybody.
Right. Yeah, it's literally
or an expression. Or anyone who gets caught with their pants down. I mean, I don't want anyone in the same room as me getting caught with their pants down. That's just uncomfortable.
You have to back out of frame. They have to do their, I got fired from ESPN press conference, and you want to be nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, it's a hassle. So just understand why your opponents are sequencing their spells the way they are, and then fight over the things that are important. Like, we preach it all the time, but you need to do playtesting to know these things, and we can't teach you. We couldn't teach you everything. Like, first of all, we don't know everything.
You don't?
So, Casey thinks he does. But, you literally, we couldn't teach you everything we know, even.
Because I learned it over hundreds and more thousands of matches of Magic.
Exactly.
Right? You can't condense that into a 1-hour podcast.
And also, those things change, right? Magic changes. Magic, it's like playing chess with, you know, 10,000 pieces that you get to pick 60 of them. It's too hard for us to tell you exactly what you should do in every situation, because every situation is different. But the thing, you just have to have reasons, and you have to do playtest. You have to playtest and know why you have those reasons. Because at the end of the day, those are the things that are going to help you the most. And like Casey said, you have to know when to hold them, when to fold them, you know, when to walk away and when to run. You know, otherwise, you're going to get caught with your pants down.
Right. And I'd like to further expand that you shouldn't count your money when you're sitting at the table. Because there's time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Thanks, Casey. All right, don't forget to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/ccmtg. We're going to adjust the goal. There's too many costs that are going into different things that we're doing on the podcast. So the tokens have been put on the back burner. The art is done. But when we get to $300 per month, we will just release the tokens to all the patrons that we have. We're relatively close to that. You know, just, you know, we hover around $200 all the time. So, you know, if you have, you know, want to see the tokens come out, please, you know, go support the podcast. You know, you don't have to do it forever, but, you know, anything helps, and we would really appreciate it. And, you know, more stuff like tokens, content, things like that come out of that. So check it out, patreon.com/ccmtg. Casey, where can people find you?
On Facebook, Casey Tuna Bloodworth, or on Twitter at CC Bloodthirst.
Or crushing fantasy football leagues.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Debatable.
All right, Gauntlet's been thrown down.
I mean, you have to. The whole point of fantasy football is to
trash talk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it's like just actually the only point of it. So starting early
and getting a trophy.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to that. The digital trophies that Yahoo sends me are actually just kind of piling up, and they don't really excite me anymore.
Can you cash them in for a physical one if you get enough? You
know, I don't know. I feel like I've got to be getting there.
Like, there's got to be like a Moto Redemption program for that, right? I have all the foil trophies.
Yeah.
Can I get a real one?
Sure. I'm gonna write them a sternly worded letter.
Michael, where can people find you?
Don't write them a sternly worded letter. They'll push your draft back by 2 hours. You can find me on Facebook in the Facebook group, Michael Hendrocker, or on Twitter at MagicMikeMTG.
You can find me on Facebook at Spencer Stephen Howland. You can find me on Twitter at Spencer13H. And you can find me on Modo at Spencer13Dev. Where you can also join the clan by messaging myself or Quentin at Earthstripe. That's URTHST. Oh, nope.
Yeah, you were on the right track. STRYPE.
Yeah. I was saying it right?
Yeah. Maybe the first time ever.
it's just habit to be wrong at this point.
Yeah. It's not funny if I don't get it wrong. Come on. It's funny because it's written down right in front of me and I'm spelling it wrong on purpose. No, that's not true. But that would be even better if in the show notes it was like, say this wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Casey did write the show, so.
Yeah, it's true.
Or he just spelled it and spelled it wrong
in the show notes. It's not in the show notes. That was all jokes. All jokes. Man, now I have to go to the show notes because I'm lost. Don't forget that you can join the conversation by tweeting with hashtag would that be good. Hashtag would that be good is our Twitter outreach program. If you tweet with hashtag would that be good, we'll check it. We'll talk to you, and all their listeners will see it. You can also go to the Reddit by going to reddit.com/r/ccmtg. You can join the Facebook group. Just, you know, ask for an invite, and as long as you're not Casey and you're trying to sell massive amounts of sunglasses, we'll let you in. I can't believe that happened. Like,
it feels so unlucky.
It's so funny because it happened. Like, we had been joking about that on the podcast for literal months.
Yeah, because and, like, it was happening so often in the Facebook group.
And then, like, one day, Casey sends out 300 and something tweets.
It's like this gets more and more every time. It was like 140.
It took a while to delete. That's all I remember.
Yeah,
I remember Casey was sitting there in the car, just like, delete. Also delete. Okay, delete. Yeah.
Basically, it tweeted out to everyone I've ever interacted with that either follows me or I follow three at a time with these.
Oh, gosh. It was so funny. Because Casey didn't know it was happening. We're sitting on the couch, and I'm like, Casey.
No, we were in the car driving back from Portland.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, like, my inbox starts blowing up, people telling me that I'm spamming them with sunglasses.
It's too great. You can also like the podcast, on Facebook and on Twitter. If you have the chance to leave us a rude review on iTunes, it'd be really appreciated. Just go find the constructive criticism on iTunes, leave us a review. It would mean the world to us. Casey, what did you learn this week?
Well, I learned kind of a lot about just specifically from worlds, sticking with things, how to like stay focused on what you're trying to accomplish. Don't let little things derail you, and like just stay hungry no matter how much success you achieve.
Michael, what did you learn this week?
I learned that the good guys always win.
This week on the podcast specifically, I learned that we have a lot more to say about counter spells than I thought we would. I think we could have gone for like another 45 minutes. This is like the brainstorm podcast we didn't know could exist.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a pretty wide swath of magic cards.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are so different. For all having like that same counter target spell line of text, they all do things so differently.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you guys all next week. And Casey, are you playing Week 1 of Fantasy?
I honestly don't remember. I know I looked, but I didn't remember.
Michael, do you know who you're playing?
Nope. I mean, it doesn't really matter.
Oh, it matters.
I am playing Adrian Carr. Suck it, Adrian.
Oh, you have to tell Adrian what my wife said.
I mean, this is a family podcast, so...
Nicely, she said, don't draft so many Seahawks.
She didn't say it nicely.
we're doing the PG version.
I think something about murdering Adrian in his sleep was very implied.
Suffocating him with a pillow. Yeah. It wasn't actually pretty intense.
Also, I had the best last pick in the draft. Did you see who I picked, Michael?
No, I put mine on auto draft to draft my defense and kicker.
I drafted Tim Tebow.
Well, you know, you're going to look real smart next fall when you start getting retroactive points for his 162 Major League Baseball games.
Right. Like, any amount of runs scored, like, they're just going to add up, right? I don't know how many fantasy football points you get for
six?
A run scored.
It's like a touchdown, right?
Oh, wow. That's powerful. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you guys all next week.
Magic.